From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Maybe in the paradise of our big brothers, they don't like that those poor, desperate, illiterate, dirty people can take their destiny in their hands. But I think that they are wrong.
John Dominique, the Haitian journalist and pro-democracy activist, assassinated just about 24 hours ago, an exclusive interview. We'll look at the Microsoft decision. A judge slams the corporate giant as being a monopoly, and a debate on the role of the White House drug office in journalism in the United States. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Attempts to wipe out poverty around the world are often hit and miss on the part of the donors and haphazard by governments, many of whom lack a coherent policy for using funds. This according to a United Nations report. Moreover, it says foreign assistance is channeled into specific projects at the whim of donors rather than having governments integrate such programs into a larger strategy. Nearly half of the world's 6 billion people live on less than $2 a day, and about 1.2 billion, or 22% of the world's population, barely survive on $1 a day. This includes 500 million in South Asia and 300 million in Africa. UN prosecutors rejoiced as the most senior war crime suspect to date was arrested this week in Bosnia and brought for trial, galvanizing their crusade to bring the architects of the Balkan so-called ethnic cleansing campaigns to justice. Momcilo Krajisnik, a close ally of former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic, was arrested at his home in Pale by French NATO troops who, witnesses said, forced open his door before dawn. Yugoslavia's state-run Tanjug news agency said Krajisnik was led away in his pajamas and bare feet. He's charged with every war crime on the Yugoslav tribunal statute, including genocide, in an indictment filed secretly by Chief Prosecutor Carla Del Ponte in February so as not to let the suspect know prosecutors were on his trail. This news from Egypt, eager to capitalize on the suspension of sanctions against his country. Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi met with German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder this morning on the fringes of a summit of African and European nations. Afterward, Schroeder said the meeting was cordial and productive. Details on the content of their discussions were not immediately available. Gaddafi, emerging from decades of international ostracism, wants to project himself to Africans as a man willing to champion their causes. The embargo on oil industry parts and air travel was suspended after Libya last year handed over for trial two suspects in the bombing of a Pan Am jetliner over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. A federal judge in Minneapolis yesterday approved class action status for a sex discrimination lawsuit on behalf of female technicians at five CBS television stations. The 1996 lawsuit accuses CBS of discriminating against its female technical employees at stations in New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Minneapolis, and Green Bay, Wisconsin. CBS spokesman Michael Silver said the network was studying the judge's decision. Certified to join the lawsuit are women who worked as technicians at WCCO-TV or in the engineering and operation department at CBS in New York, KCBS in Los Angeles, BBM-TV in Chicago, and WFRV-TV in Green Bay, beginning in October of 1993. Thousands of janitors seeking higher pay went on strike yesterday in Los Angeles, a walkout that could affect about 70% of the commercial office space in Los Angeles County. Contracts between 18 cleaning contractors and 8,500 janitors expired Friday night. Both sides said they were so far apart that further negotiations would be pointless. About 3,000 union members authorized the strike yesterday, an action that could be a precursor to nationwide disruptions as contracts covering 100,000 janitors expire in coming months. This news from Boston. Massachusetts put the nation's strictest gun regulations into effect yesterday, using consumer protection rules to ban cheap Saturday night specials and require child-proof locks on any guns sold in the state. The state will contact gun manufacturers and sellers within 15 days to inform them of the regulations, which also require safety warnings with each gun, tamper-resistant serial numbers, and indicators on semi-automatic handguns that tell if a bullet is in the chamber. And the number of Black and Latino freshmen admitted to the University of California system has rebounded to the level it was when affirmative action was still in place. However, much of the recovery is because more Blacks and Hispanics are being admitted to lesser-known campuses. The flagship Berkeley campus is still well below the 1997 totals, as is UCLA. Regent Bill Bagley, who opposed dropping affirmative action, said he was pleased by the enrollment increases, but said it's still a fact that the flagship campuses of Berkeley and UCLA are being seriously deprived of diversity.
This morning, I would like to use as a subject from which to preach the drum major instinct. And our text for the morning is taken from a very familiar passage in the 10th chapter as recorded by St. Mark, beginning with the 35th verse of that chapter. We read these words: "And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came unto him, saying, Master, we would that thou shouldest do for us whatsoever we shall desire. And he said unto them, What would ye that I should do for you? They said unto him, Grant unto us that we may sit, one on thy right hand and the other on thy left hand, in thy glory. But Jesus said unto them, Ye know not what ye ask. Can ye drink of the cup that I drink of, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said unto him, We can. And Jesus said unto them, Ye shall indeed drink of the cup that I drink of, and with the baptism that I am baptized withal shall ye be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give."
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., 32 years ago, he was gunned down. This is the anniversary, April 4th, 2000. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Army colonel, once in charge of the U.S. military's anti-drug efforts in Colombia, has been charged with covering up the money laundering activities of his wife, who's pleaded guilty to drug smuggling. In a letter written yesterday to a New York federal judge, prosecutors reveal that Colonel James Hyatt is charged with ignoring a felony committed by Lori Hyatt. The charge carries a maximum sentence of 3 years in prison. After Lori Hyatt's arrest made headlines, she pleaded guilty on January 27th to a plan to smuggle $700,000 worth of heroin into the United States, largely by mailing drug-filled packages from Colombia to this country and traveling to New York to collect the profits. At the time of his wife's smuggling, Hyatt was in charge of the estimated 200 U.S. troops in Colombia, training security forces for counter-drug operations and protecting three large radar bases used primarily to track drug flights. He asked to be reassigned after his wife's arrest and was transferred to the Army's Training and Doctrine Command at Fort Monroe, Virginia, where he remains on active duty. He's scheduled to retire in November. The two reportedly discussed how to transfer large amounts of cash to the United States without generating legally mandated currency reports as Army CID agents prepared to search their apartment after Lori Hyatt's arrest, the sources told the Washington Post. Hyatt moved the money to his embassy safe. Once in the United States, they deposited small sums in various banks to avoid reporting requirements. Again, this is the latest news on the highest warrior in the U.S. drug war in Colombia and his involvement in the smuggling of drugs into the United States. Well, we're going to take a look at a story closer to home, and it's how the U.S. press covers the so-called drug war. We're joined right now by two people. We are joined by Rob Hausman, who is a spokesperson for the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which is where the drug czar, Barry McCaffrey, resides. And there's been a controversy over the last months around the issue of U.S. magazines and newspapers and TV and radio stations getting thousands of dollars of financial credits for articles that they have written that the drug czar approves of. We'd like to have this clarified first by our spokesperson for the drug czar, Rob Hausman. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, how are you?
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us what this program is?
Sure. The program is what we call the Youth Media Campaign. What the program does is it uses the full power of modern media, everything from television to the internet to radio to magazines, to send kids positive, scientifically proven messages to empower them to reject drugs. As part of the program, the Congress mandated that to maximize our ability to reach children and to maximize the return on the taxpayer dollar, because remember, this comes out of all of our pockets as part of our budget, we have to get what we call one-to-one match. What that means is for every taxpayer dollar we spend, that the media has to provide an equal dollar's worth of public service back to the campaign, back to the people, to reach kids and parents and others. The way that works is sort of twofold. One, they can do it through other advertising. In other words, if we buy a primetime ad on TV, the media can provide directly one other primetime ad. Alternatively, they can also get creative. For example, they can work on internet projects. They can do grassroots efforts within their community. And in some cases, they can provide, after the fact, after it's already been run, examples of what they've already been doing on the drug issue to reach kids in specific and therefore get credit for that. I'd add, though, that we don't provide credit for hard news. For example, in newspapers, we do not give at all newspapers credit for stories they've run. That would be crossing the line into editorial, and we don't want to do that.
Well, then Daniel Forbes, who's a writer for Salon Magazine, also testified before Congress on this issue. What's your problem with this?
Well, Amy, I personally have no particular problem with it. I'm just trying to report what's out there. Mr. Hausman, good morning. We've met.
Good morning, Dan. How are you?
Good. But what we have here is an approach at financial incentives encouraging a particular point of view. The federal government's drug policies represent a political platform. And, for instance, taxpayer money is only going to magazines that have an anti-drug profile. Just to give two quick examples, Family Circle, according to a research service, had 8.5 pages of anti-drug material. It got the second highest ONDCP ad buy of $1.4 million. Its very close competitor, Woman's Day, had 0 pages in 1999, got not a single dollar of anti-drug money. For advertising pages. Sporting News had half a dozen anti-drug articles, and in some cases The writer was requested by ONDCP.
Actually,
that's what Robert Lapchick of the Northeastern told
Dan,
me.
If I may finish
with my example, Sport Magazine, just to finish, versus Sporting News.
That is factually incorrect. I have spoken to the publisher, the person that Mr. Lapchick said made that statement, and he firmly denies it.
It was the writer's understanding that, quote from the writer, Robert Lapchick, who had severed his relationship with the Sporting News, had moved on to writing for another publication, said to me, quote unquote, ONDCP requested me.
Did you ask
his
publisher about that?
This is the understanding of the writer.
Did you confirm it with the person who supposedly said
it? The publisher was no longer returning my calls. I quoted the writer as saying so.
No, but Dan, you may have quoted the wrong person in this instance. I have for you here, and I'm happy to provide it for you, and I hope that you'll correct the record.
That was the writer's understanding.
An email directed to me from the publisher that specifically says that he did not do that.
I quoted only the writer's understanding that after he had moved on to another publication.
Dan, I understand that.
Well, anyway,
Mr. Hausman, you may be wrong.
That's a small.
You've been wrong throughout this reporting. You were wrong in saying it was
Mr.
secret.
Hausman,
the New York
Family
Times
Circle had
record.
$1.4 million in anti-drug advertising buys. They had 8.5 pages of anti-drug content.
Is that a bad thing?
Woman's Day had 0 pages,
but
zero anti-drug buys. Sport had 0 pages, a very small buy. The government is rewarding a congruent.
No,
the government
incorrect.
Is rewarding a congruent. If you'd not interrupt me, please. The government is rewarding a congruent editorial environment. 17 magazine was paid more than $70,000, according to its ad salesperson Jackie O'Hare, to include a description of a young girl in jail for 10 years. To include that on their website. She told me it was extremely unusual for 17 to take an article from the printed magazine and put it on their website. They were compensated. It was valued by Ogilvy & Mather, the Drug Czar's ad agency.
Here again, you're incorrect.
Well, I'm only quoting the salesperson of 17 magazine.
I checked yesterday. It hasn't been valued. Here again, you're incorrect.
We're talking with Daniel Forbes, who is a Salon magazine, the online magazine reporter, who's done a series of pieces on this, including the drug war gravy train, how the White House rewarded U.S. News, 17, and other magazines for publishing anti-drug articles. And our guest on the phone is Rob Hausman, who is Assistant Director of Strategic Planning at the Office of National Drug Control Policy, works with the drug czar, Barry McCaffrey. Rob Hausman, you were saying.
Amy, let me go back and sort of, Dan's reporting on this has been half truth and half made up. Let me go back and correct the record on a couple of these things. First of all, Dan may not like it, but we're buying a wide range of magazines, and not all of them always agree with us. For example, we buy ads in Newsweek, we buy ads in Time, we buy ads in a variety of places, a variety of media outlets, that haven't always seen eye to eye with us on various drug issues. Now, the reason why we're buying them is not because of their editorial focus. We're buying them because they are an effective vehicle to reach either parents and other adult mentors of kids or kids themselves. And I can show you exactly why certain magazines get bought. But the bottom line is, it's not about editorial content. It's about reach and frequency, the ability to deliver messages. First of all,
Mr. Hausman,
no, Dan,
Mr. Hausman,
all
right,
run,
I'm responding.
If I may,
26,
Dan, I gave you the run. Now you get to listen to me.
26 publications.
Dan, I gave you the run of the mic.
Let
now
me
you
just
get
make
to
one point. I'll let you go.
I now
26,
get to correct the record.
26
if I may,
publications
no,
were bought.
Dan, let me put it to you this way.
Six,
you reported that this campaign was
six
secret.
Submitted
the New York
editorial
Times relied on your reporting.
For evaluation.
Amy, if I may.
Yes, go ahead, Rob Hausman. Yeah.
Dan, you said that this campaign was secret. The New York Times relied on your reporting. Max Frankel relied on your reporting. And the New York Times has had to correct the record. The New York Times has had to go on record saying they were wrong to rely on you, part one. Part two, you've said now that a bunch of these things have been valued. They haven't been valued yet, Dan. I don't even know the value, and I work here.
I said that six publications
Dan, if you'll
submitted
allow me.
Their six
Dan,
of
if you'll
six
allow me.
Publications.
Let Dan Forbes respond to what you said.
26 publications received an ONDCP ad buy during calendar year 99. Six magazines, U.S. News and World Report, Family Circle, 17, The Sporting News, and the two biggest circulation in the country, Parade and U.S. Weekend, all on the record quotes from their own executives, either publishing or sales executives. Well, those six said that they submitted editorial content 2, ONDCP and its ad agency for valuation. It was still up in the air whether they
Correct.
All would be done or not.
No,
the fact that they are
done.
Saying that this editorial content should meet with the drug czar's approval and release them
but
from financial obligations raises questions.
No, Dan.
Secondly,
wait.
As to the television advertising you referred to, I never said it was secret.
Yes,
I said
did.
I that was a headline
no,
in the
No, no,
in
no, no. It was known only to a small group.
Not,
Dan, I've read your reporting.
It was not known to the congressional subcommittee chairman did not know
Dan,
about it.
It was
the Hollywood executive.
On the record.
The Colby of Arizona and Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell of Colorado
Dan,
did not
Dan,
know.
If I may,
they are the subcommittee chairman.
Believe, Dan,
if they don't know,
that
it was
sub rosa. If we were going to keep something secret, it would run on the front page of the Los Angeles Times.
If the chairman,
you honestly believe
if
that?
If the chairman of the
Let Dan Forbes respond.
If the chairman of the two subcommittees involved with financial oversight, Representative Jim Colby, Republican of Arizona, and Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, Republican of Colorado, neither one knew of this provision to value network television, I would maintain that that is an extremely covert effort on your part if neither of those chairmen knew.
The New York Times relied on you have to correct the record on that.
I believe the New York Times has their own agenda. You'll have
no,
to
no,
ask
no.
them.
You know, the New York Times had to correct the record based upon
sir,
your reporting.
Sir, neither
Do you
of
know
the,
that?
Neither,
Dan, are you aware? Just
I
tell
sir,
me, are you aware
that's a
that
column
the
by
let him
Max,
let him respond.
That's a column by Max Frankel. It's hard news. Please address the fact that neither of the congressional chairmen involved knew of this, nor I interviewed. So, how could then there have been disclosure on ONDCP's part?
I have personally made available to Salon Magazine, your publisher, the
extensive. Wait a minute. Answer the question regarding Colby and Senator Campbell.
And are you going to allow me to answer
yeah,
that
I'd
question?
Like you to answer
well,
that
why don't
question,
you answer that question first
Dan,
and then
look,
make your point about these politicians knowing?
Colby and Campbell told me on the record neither one knew. They're the people's representatives in Congress who are supposed to have oversight for this.
Well, allow me to
Only obfuscatory language in the extreme was presented to them in testimony.
Amy,
they didn't know.
Amy, if you'll give me about 5 minutes, I'll be able to read the director's October 21, 1990.
I can't give you 5 minutes because you're going
that.
On to a Microsoft
of
debate.
Of course you can. Because
phrases
you can,
such as pro
Dan,
bono, public
Dan,
service,
let Rob Hausman respond.
Dan, I let you talk.
Actually,
respond.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we'll give you a minute after the break, and then we're going on to the ruling of the judge yesterday that Microsoft is a monopoly. We're going to get a response from Microsoft in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our guest, Rob Hausman, Assistant Director of Strategic Planning, Office of National Drug Control Policy, Office of the Drug Czar, Dan Forbes, reporter with Salon Magazine, who broke the story on the relationship between the U.S. media and the drug czar's office. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Rob Hausman, our guest on the phone from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, about this controversy around awarding thousands of dollars of financial credits under a federal advertising program that rewards TV stations, newspapers, magazines, if they put out a message, a so-called on-message message on the war on drugs. Our guest in the studio, Dan Forbes, freelancer with Salon Magazine, who broke the story. Rob Hausman, you were just saying, and we can only give you each a minute now to give a final sum up on the bigger picture here.
Well, first of all, Amy, Dan no more broke this story than anybody who read the August 20th, 1998 L.A. Times. It was this exact part of the campaign was covered on the front page of the L.A. Times. So anybody who read it has the same claim that Dan does to breaking it. Second of all, Dan's reporting on this has been littered with factual error. The New York Times has had to correct the record based upon their reliance on Dan's reporting. Now he's falsely quoted a publisher that he never spoke with, but he spoke with a reporter but didn't think to go back up the chain because he's been slovenly in the reporting. Moreover, he's been willfully blind to fact. On October 21st, 1999, the director testified about this arrangement. And if Dan thinks the Congress didn't know about it, he should be well to be reminded that the Congress required this. They voted on it. They put it in place. We didn't do this on our own. The Congress itself, these chairmen and others, voted this requirement into place. I don't see how you can say that they were blind to it.
Well, Rob Hausman, since I gave you the first word, I'll give Dan Forbes the last word, and then we move on to Microsoft.
Well, on that small point, neither subcommittee chairman knew. They didn't know until I approached them. On larger points, let's put this in perspective. ONDCP sent formal printed...
The Drug Czar's Office.
The Drug Czar's Office, Amy, sent formal printed instructions requesting specific content in magazines, even down to the point of asking for... suggesting that different types of articles appear in different months. This was a formal printed document that was sent out. We have such absurdities as the sales staff as USA Weekend, cutting and pasting different paragraphs from four different articles, I was told by Lisa Helbron, one of their sales execs, in an attempt to add up to sufficient amount of column inches to achieve the valuation. As to that last point, I can't let the slovenly slide. I spoke to the publisher of the Sporting News. I then spoke to his writer, Lapchick, subsequently, and then was dealing with Times Mirror PR. And they did not, Times Mirror did not make anyone available.
Well, on that note, we do have to end this debate, but I want to give you each a chance to give out more information. You have a website where people can get your articles, Dan Forbes, Rob Hausman, where people can get more information on this program from the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Well, they can go to www.WhiteHouseDrugPolicy, or they can go to www.ProjectKnow, spelled K-N-O-W, and hear more about this.
And Dan Forbes.
I can only refer folks to Salon.com. That's Salon Magazine. I had articles on the 31st of March, on January 13th, and January 14th on this issue.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, and we'll continue to follow that story. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! News just in, the U.S. diplomatic mission in Havana will hand over six visas today to the father of six-year-old shipwreck survivor Elian Gonzalez and five others to travel to the United States in a bid to take charge of the boy. The other big story of the day is the story of Microsoft. A ruling in the Microsoft antitrust case. Yesterday, U.S. District Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson said that Microsoft is a monopoly and used anti-competitive means to maintain its power. Jackson says Microsoft attempted to monopolize the web browser market and unlawfully tied Internet Explorer, its web browser, to its operating system. Jackson said the software giant could be sued under state anti-competition laws. The government hailed the ruling as good for consumers, leading to more competition in the high-tech industry. We'll go first to the Attorney General of the United States, Janet Reno's response.
The court agreed with the department that Microsoft abused its monopoly power, that it violated the antitrust laws, and that it harmed consumers. Microsoft has been held accountable for its illegal conduct by a court of law. Throughout the process, our goal has been to give consumers the benefits of competition. With competition comes more innovation, better products, lower prices, and more choices. Thanks to this ruling, consumers who have been harmed can now look forward to benefits.
We now go to Bill Gates, the head of Microsoft.
I want to say a few words about today's ruling and how we look at these issues going forward. Today's ruling was not unexpected, given the court's earlier findings, but there are several steps ahead in this case. Well, we did everything we could to settle this case, and we'll continue to look for new opportunities to resolve it. We believe we have a strong case on appeal. The appeals court has already affirmed Microsoft's right to build internet capabilities into the Windows operating system to benefit consumers. This ruling turns on its head the reality that consumers know, that our software has helped make PCs more accessible and affordable to millions. We started with just a few simple ideas, and the results have helped bring lower prices, improved productivity, and enormous benefits to consumers. As we look ahead to the appeals process, innovation will continue to be the number one priority at Microsoft. Microsoft's past success has been built on innovation and creativity, and our future success depends on that ability to keep innovating in the fastest changing marketplace on Earth. We recognize we have a responsibility to provide positive leadership on behalf of consumers and our industry.
Microsoft leader Bill Gates responding to the judge's decision declaring Microsoft a monopoly. We're joined right now by Jim Cullinan, a Microsoft spokesperson. Jim Cullinan, the headlines today in some of the papers, tech wreck, Microsoft ruling sends NASDAQ into nosedive, Microsoft guilty, just a few of the headlines. Your response?
Well, we've been here before. This was not a ruling that was unexpected based on the court's previous ruling on findings of fact. So this was certainly anticipated. It's our belief that this is still a long process ahead. We believe we have a great basis for appealing this ruling, and think at the end of the day, when you look at what Microsoft has done for this industry and the economy of bringing low prices and great technology to consumers, that in the end, Microsoft's legal position will win out.
Bob Landy, your response, professor, University of Baltimore Law School and scholar with the American Antitrust Institute in Washington.
I think the decision is a very sound decision. It explains very carefully and unemotionally how Microsoft's actions prevented others from innovating. That's the key to this all. No one has ever suggested that Microsoft cannot innovate, but it did activity after activity, which had no other purpose than preventing others from innovating, others from giving consumers the products that the marketplace demanded. And that's why the judge condemned them, and that's why I believe ultimately the Supreme Court will uphold this judge's findings.
That's a very interesting point of someone saying that the industry isn't innovating and developing new products, because when we're out here with the competitors and all these new companies announcing a new technology and a new product every single day with millions, almost billions of dollars of venture capital being thrown at new companies with a new idea, there is no way that any company is prevented from developing products or technology. It's simply an effort of consumers choosing which is the best one. And you look over the history of this industry, even in the past 5 years when this case is being discussed about, no one can say that there isn't a huge amount of competition and a huge amount of new technology and innovation in this industry. And if you do that, you simply aren't accepting the reality of the marketplace.
May I respond to that?
Yes.
The judge...
That was, by the way, Jim Cullinan and Microsoft spokesperson Bob Landy, professor, University of Baltimore Law School.
Thank you. Thank you. The judge specifically found that anyone who innovates in an area that Microsoft covets had the stuffing stomped out of it. Finding after finding by the judge, if you made a browser and Microsoft wanted the browser market, you got stomped. If you made a Java that would allow others to possibly form another operating system, or there are a lot of other purposes for Java, you would get stomped. In short, there's lots of innovation, but it had to be innovation on Microsoft's terms. Every argument that Jim made was already made to the judge and rejected. We can fight those arguments again if you like, but the judge found that Microsoft had reduced innovation in this market. If you want to re-argue that, you can, Jim, but we're wasting our time.
Well, we have an appeals court to go and talk to, and I think they will have a different view on what this was, what this court ruled.
With due respect, if you win at the appeals court, you're not going to win on that point, Jim, with due respect. That is, there are some vulnerabilities in the judge's ruling. He might be overturned on the tying issue, for example. I fully concede that, but that Microsoft has a monopoly and did numerous anti-competitive actions to stop others from innovating, I would doubt very, very much that's going to be overturned on appeal.
Jim Cullen, and Microsoft spokesperson. And let me ask this question. Why the decision was made not to allow arbitration to continue? Why the talks broke down and you feel that you have a better chance in an appeals court?
Well, Microsoft took the mediation process with Judge Posner very seriously. And as Judge Posner said in his statement ending the mediation process, there were 20 successive drafts over a four-month period, and Microsoft believe we made significant concessions, more so than we believe what will be provided by the judicial process, because we thought it was in the best interest of all parties to put this issue behind us. Unfortunately, we believe that we were talking to not just one party on the other side of the table, but two. And there were simply no, we weren't talking to a party with one voice. There was very big differences amongst the other, between the states and the DOJ. And those remedies that they were being discussed were extreme and radical. And it's very, very difficult to be able to come to some agreement when you have to deal with such extreme and radical remedies.
What would happen if Microsoft were broken up? How would it divide?
Well, we're certainly not going to talk about that because we don't believe that.
I would be delighted to talk about that.
All right, let's just get Mr. Cullen in response.
Well, we believe that any idea of breaking up Microsoft is very, very bad for this industry, bad for the economy, and bad for Microsoft. When you're talking about a company, a single organic company has never been broken up before, and it is simply a company that has been developed to create great products. When you talk about $3 billion in research and development every single day, us developing new technologies that all of our products can benefit from, and when you're talking about great technologies that quickly need to be involved in all of our products, you're talking about a company that works together, and we're not an AT&T or Standard Oil where it's pasted together of different companies. This is a single organic company that works together that must innovate to stay competitive.
And Bob Landy, a scholar at the American Antitrust Institute in Washington.
I think the best thing for consumers and overall industry innovation would be a breakup of Microsoft. You asked how the breakup could work. There are a number of ways in which it could work. I think the best way would be to take Judge Bork's solution. Judge Bork suggested break Microsoft into three companies, give each of the three companies all of the intellectual property for all of Microsoft. Then they could all make Windows, they could all make whatever Microsoft product. And then instead of one company with 90%+ of a bunch of markets, you'd have three companies with 30%. And then they could go out and do basically anything they want without fear of the antitrust laws. I think one reason why you need a structural remedy is in 1995, Microsoft signed a consent decree and then wiggled out of it. And the government just doesn't trust Microsoft to live up to the terms of its consent order. They proposed a lot of consent orders that, according to the press, because I haven't seen them, were riddled with loopholes. And the government simply said, well, gee, Microsoft wriggled out of it in 1995. If we accept one of these consent orders, Microsoft will wriggle out of it again. The only way to make sure that the market is going to be competitive in the future is to remove their base of monopoly power, i.e. break them up.
Sorry, Bob. Your view of us wriggling out of something isn't the reality. The appeals court completely supported our view of the consent decree, and we won that unanimously. And the government's contention that we somehow wriggled out, as you claim, is just not the reality, and the appeals court supported us on that. And the whole point is that these whole contention of Bob and other people who are talking about radical and extreme, because they're talking about things of going back to the Unix world where it was divided and split, which has been bad, which caused higher prices, caused confusion amongst consumers. This is not a, what the consumers want is a PC or a software that is easy to use and easy to understand. Microsoft developed a business model that was high volume, low prices, and good technology, and consumers embraced that because Windows is a good product. We develop our technology by spending billions of dollars in research and development and creating great software, and Microsoft has been great for consumers. And any
we just have 20 seconds. I want to give Bob Lundy a last response.
My Windows crashes twice a day. I wish there was some competition in the Windows market. Competition is what drives consumer welfare. Consumers are not better off if there's a monopoly who controls the market. And when a monopoly has abused its monopoly power the way the judge has found Microsoft has, the only way to ensure competition in the future is to break up that monopoly power. I think that would be the best solution in this particular case. Microsoft has done a lot of wonderful things. They've also done a lot of anti-competitive things, and I want to make sure that doesn't happen in the future.
We have to end this discussion. We want to thank Bob Lundy, professor, University of Baltimore Law School, scholar with the American Antitrust Institute in Washington, and get your coordinates. If people want to call the American Antitrust Institute or go on the web, where can they go?
They can just do www.antitrustinstitute.org, or you can just phone me at 301-585-5229.
And Jim McCullen, and I'm sure people won't have much trouble finding Microsoft, but where can they go on the web?
You can go up onto the web at www.microsoft.com, and for further information or to look at the ruling from the court or anything, just go to www.microsoft.com/presspass, one word, and all the information is up there.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to Haiti to hear this exclusive interview with Jean Dominique. It was done just weeks before he was gunned down yesterday as he was heading into his office, Radio Haiti Inter, one of the leading pro-democracy human rights activists and journalists. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Haiti's democratic movement remained in shock today, just 24 hours after pioneering radio broadcaster and leading pro-democracy activist Jean Dominique was gunned down in the courtyard of his radio station. As reported on Democracy Now! Yesterday, gunmen ambushed the 69-year-old Dominique as he was getting out of his car outside of Radio Haiti Inter in downtown Port-au-Prince. The security guard at the station was also killed. Police said two people fled from the scene in a pickup truck. The attack generated widespread condemnation in Haiti and around the world. The Organization of American States says the killing constitutes an attack against the freedom of the press and democracy in Haiti. The assassination comes in the midst of fierce election year battle for thousands of municipal and regional posts, as well as parliamentary seats. Later this year, Haitians are slated to vote in presidential elections. Jean Dominique was leading crusader against the Duvalier family dictatorship in the 70s and 80s and was the first Haitian radio journalist to broadcast in Creole instead of French, the language used by Haiti's tiny but powerful elite. Dominique and his family fled into exile during Baby Doc Duvalier's regime in 1980 and returned after Duvalier was ousted in 86. the night of the 1991 army coup that overthrew Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first freely elected president. Gunmen attacked Radio Haiti Inter and ransacked the station. Dominique again went into exile and returned to Haiti in 94 after the army was ousted with the help of the U.S.-led invasion forces. We turn for a minute before we go to this interview with Jean-Dominique, one of the last interviews he did, certainly with an international journalist. We go to Ray LaForest, who is a Haitian-American activist. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ray.
Good morning, me.
Can you give us a little background, since you personally knew Jean-Dominique well, your families were close?
Yeah, I knew Jean. Jean was, he's older than I am, but his older brother, Philippe, was my father's closest friend, and Jean comes from a background of liberal politics, of a family that was dedicated to change. And as I mentioned earlier, his brother was involved in the first attack against the Duvalier dictatorship in 1957 and was killed in the process. Jean is known, I can tell you that the radio stations in Brooklyn are ablaze, not only with shock, but people's anger, denouncing the killing and calling for retribution and striking back at the enemies of the people. Jean was a towering figure. He had an acid tongue at times and could be as hard as tack as a nail. He had a clear vision of where he wanted to go, where Haiti should be, and the right to free speech was one of them. Even though he was a tremendous supporter of President Aristide, he was never in anybody's pocket. And I can tell you that in New York, the reaction is tremendous. People are looking at ways to express their not only their outrage, but recognize the tremendous job that he has done. I've spoken to people yesterday telling me how they remember the role the station played after the overthrow of Baby Doc during those very difficult, dangerous years between 1986 and the election of Aristide, when the forces that controlled Haiti for 30 years were using violence to prevent consolidation of democracy. And Jean was always at the forefront of that fight.
And Jean-Dominique was also following in the tradition of his brother.
Yes. His brother, Philippe, was one of the few rare breed of Haitian officers who really believed in that the army could play a role in assisting positive change in Haiti and died for it. There are very few people like that. Some of them are people like Frank Larac, who's a very well-known a professor here, we just retired, and writer, and who dedicated his life also to that kind of activity.
His brother dying in a coup attempt against Duvalier.
The first one.
Hmm. Well, Ray LaForest, I want to thank you for being with us. And with that, we're going to move into the interview that we have. We're going to take a look at contemporary Haiti with one of the last interviews, if not the last, that Jean-Dominique gave to a U.S. broadcast network. Pacifica Radio's Dan Coughlin interviewed Jean-Dominique earlier this year at his radio station in Port-au-Prince. Dominique starts by talking about the upcoming elections and the role of the U.S. Agency for International Development, known as USAID, the vehicle through which the U.S. funnels huge amounts of money into Haiti, influencing both the economy and politics of the poorest country in the hemisphere.
Haiti is moving into a new election phase. What's at stake in these both the parliamentary elections coming up and the presidential elections later this year? What's at stake?
Recently and for many times, the Prime Minister, agronome Jacques-Édouard Alexis, said, and I quote, "This election is something very important for the national sovereignty." And he repeated this statement many, many times. Why? Because the Prime Minister last year tried to stop an attempt by USAID, Mrs. Phyllis Forbes, of course, who wanted to finance directly a private company, COD, that was supposed to produce the electoral cards with photo, and USAID decide to give directly the money to this company through an NGO called IFES, which is an NGO working inside the electoral body. So the electoral process, starting with the registration of citizen, is obviously under the management of a foreign company financed by a foreign power without any accountability for us Haitian citizens. That's the first point. And I can tell you that the Prime Minister lost. And the USAID is financing directly the production of this inscription, of this registration card. So you can understand what is at stake. First point, we can ask one question about this electoral process. Through the experience of IFES, which is the NGO with the mandate of going along with the electoral process, and with COD, the private company for the inscription, the registration card. The problem is, are we going towards an electoral process where all, and I said all, the Haitian citizens will be able to register first, then to vote? The answer is no, because we have 565 counties in Haiti. And actually, IFES and CORD and CEP are preparing for 4,000 registration offices. That means less than 5 registration offices for one county. How can you register 4 million citizens with 5 registration offices for each county? Facing this problem and this danger, there has been a lot of peasant organization throughout the country asking the electoral body to start the registration process outside the cities and in the rural counties, in order to allow all the peasants in the country to register. They are afraid to be excluded of the electoral process. It is exactly what is at stake. Are we going toward an electoral process where only a minority of citizens will go to vote? The majority of the citizens will be excluded of the vote. And as one of the peasant leaders told publicly 6 days ago, is this electoral process going toward an electronic result decide before the vote? That's the problem.
We're speaking with Jean Dominique, the director of Radio Haiti Inter, arguably the most important radio station here in Port-au-Prince in terms of news and information. Radio Haiti has been at the forefront of the democratic struggle, of the struggle against the Duvalier dictatorship through the 70s and 80s and the military regimes that followed. Let's talk about this a little bit more. What is the purpose of the electoral card?
First of all, let's say that the fact that they decide to put an electoral registration card with the picture of the citizen was a very, very, very good decision, very good initiative. This initiative was contrary to all bad electoral practices of the past, where there was what we call magouille, possibility for a candidate to collect 100 registration card and sell them to the voters. No more, because every citizen will be with his registration card with his picture. That's a very positive fact. But the fact that the company in charge of doing those registration card with picture first and giving it to the citizen, this company and the NGO did not prepare the spreading of the process throughout Haiti in order to that the majority will not be practically able to register. I can tell you that throughout Haiti now, more and more poor citizens are asking questions. What question? There has been, with the actual government of President Préval, many attempts to put in practice what the Constitution calls decentralization. Decentralization. What does that mean? That means that the small communities are actually able to take their own affairs in their hands. That's power to the local government. That's decentralization. Contrary to the Haitian tradition of centralization, everything in the National Palace. Now, every community has the chance to take in their hand their business, the business of the community, which is a fantastic step for democracy, actually. And because of this decentralization process, actually in process, the poor citizens are saying, but we are the master of our destiny. We can now start taking care of ourselves. And they are saying, if we have to vote for the local government, we have to participate, because those people will be our people. We are going to hire them in the same way we can in four years fire them. So the sense of citizenship is actually emerging and spreading. That's a wonderful step in the process of democracy in Haiti. Maybe our masters don't like this process. Maybe in the paradise of our big brothers, they don't like that those poor, desperate, illiterate, dirty people can take their destiny in their hands. But I think that they are wrong. They are wrong with their own principle. Because a town meeting in the United States is not a revolutionary, is it? Revolutionary. When the citizen go to a town meeting to discuss things about his town, his city, he's a normal citizen. We want our democracy based on town meetings. We want our democracy based on the Jefferson principles. Is Jefferson contrary to Washington now?
Jean Dominique, assassinated yesterday morning in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, as he and his security guard were going into his offices at Radio Haiti Inter. When I was covering Haiti during the coup and spending time there, as well as when Jean-Bertrand Aristide returned, I got a chance to also meet Jean Dominique as I went into his offices and saw the bullet-ridden place that he calls home because he was such a threat to the dictatorships. That interview done by Pacifica Radio's Dan Coughlin, who spent time with Jean Dominique just a few months ago. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we wrap up today, if you'd like to order a cassette copy of the program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Errol Maitland, our technical director, is still hospitalized after covering a police attack on funeral marchers last week in the police killing of an unarmed Haitian American in New York. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love, Karen Palmer, and Maria Carrion. Our engineer today, Matthew Finch. You can email us and email letters to Errol at democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.